Thousands of U.S. troops and tanks invade a peaceful Iraq, raining bombs over the capital city of Baghdad in its drive to remove Iraqi President Saddam Hussein from office. This is a special edition of Peace Watch for Friday, March 21st, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The shock and awe campaign the Pentagon has bragged about for weeks is underway in Iraq. A barrage of powerful explosives crashed down earlier today on Baghdad, sending enormous fireballs and mushroom clouds of smoke billowing high into the night sky above the Iraqi capital. Some 2 hours later, the distinct sound of aircraft could be heard over Baghdad for the first time since the start of the U.S.-led attack on Iraq. A huge fire raged to the south of the city. The red glow of the flames illuminated the horizon. Independent journalist Mei Ying Welsh is one of the few independent journalists in Baghdad. In an interview with CNN moments after the bombing, she gave an eyewitness account.
I have not seen ambulances going by, and I did see that last night. I've not seen fire trucks going by. I did see that last night. I'm not seeing a lot of running around, actually, on the part of the Iraqi government. I'm not seeing a lot of cars. And actually, strangely enough, about a half an hour ago, I heard a demonstration in the streets. There were people that came out into the streets to demonstrate against this bombing. Every single person in this city heard and felt that bombing. It's quite a terrifying experience, to be honest with you. I mean, it's heart-stopping when these bombs fall because they just have a very huge impact. They send some kind of shockwave through the air, and you just feel like the ground shake underneath you. And the sound of these missiles streaking by is quite terrifying as well because you hear it and it sounds like it's coming towards you, you know? It shrieks by, and you don't know where it's going to fall. And I have no doubt that right now people are huddled in their homes and, you know, trying to calm their children down, trying to calm their wives down. I mean, right now I'm sure that the people of this city are very, very much huddling in their homes and hoping and praying that this bombing ends soon. A lot of apartment buildings, for instance, the residential buildings right around me, all have shelters built into their basement, so the people can descend into the shelter. And most of these buildings actually are dark because the people in them have left Baghdad and gone perhaps to outlying towns and villages or perhaps maybe even left the country. But I was able to speak with a woman who lives in the apartment building right next to me. She told me she's absolutely terrified. And then one of her relatives said, no, we're not afraid. And they had an argument, one of them saying, we're not afraid, we're Iraqis, we're not afraid. And the other one saying, no, I am afraid, I'm terrified. They said they would go down into the shelter tonight. Some other buildings may not have shelters but have shelters, freestanding shelters near them where people can go to. But I have to say that people have a very vivid memory here of the 1991 bombing of the Amariya shelter in which over 400 women and children died. Men, women, and children, most of them women and children, died. Event is commemorated every year here in Iraq. It's not forgotten. And a lot of people have told me they're afraid to go to shelters because they're afraid the U.S. will bomb them.
Independent journalist Mei Ying Welsh speaking from Baghdad. In an interview earlier today with Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!, she talked about conditions she observed during a visit to a hospital and her assessment of the number of Iraqi casualties so far.
I only know what we knew as of this morning, which was that the official count was 37 civilian casualties. I was able to see a lot of those people in the hospital. I can confirm at least some of them were definitely civilians. I have no idea how many casualties there are now.
Mei Ying Welsh, independent correspondent inside Baghdad, Iraq. Thanks to CNN for portions of that report and Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! One of the first targets in the Pentagon's sights was the town of Safwan in the southern Iraq and the strategic Gulf port of Umm Qasr. U.S. and British forces seized that city today after ground forces plowed through with thousands of tanks. Two U.S. Marines died in ground fighting, bringing the death toll of Allied forces to 14. Both troops who died were were with the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force. The 1st Marine died early today while his platoon battled Iraqi infantry to secure an oil pumping station in southern Iraq. Jacqueline Cabasso, executive director of the Western States Legal Foundation, is skeptical of the Bush administration's stated goal for invading Iraq. She says liberating the Iraqi people is only one of the many shifting rationales put forward by the Bush administration for invading that country.
For a while, there was a major emphasis on disarming the Iraqi regime from its alleged weapons of mass destruction, which have never been proven, by the way. Then it was to overthrow the regime of Saddam Hussein. For a while, it was to bring democracy to the Middle East. And actually, what we had was a succession of justifications, ever-changing, which actually the Iraqi regime could not possibly meet. In other words, it was a constantly shifting goalpost. And I came to the conclusion some weeks ago that there was absolutely nothing that Saddam Hussein and his regime could do that would satisfy these ever-changing U.S. requirements, because the United States was absolutely intent on going to war with or without a United Nations mandate, with or without global majority opinion on its side, and it has unfortunately done so. It has entered into a very aggressive, unilateral, illegal, an immoral war, which has all kinds of potentially very devastating consequences.
So if not to disarm Saddam Hussein or to create a regime change or to liberate the people of Iraq, what do you believe the real intention is?
Well, I think that the real intention is to extend the U.S. global empire, to establish a strong regional base for the U.S. global empire, and to assure Iraqi oil for U.S. interests.
It has been reported so far since the U.S. has gone in with its invasion that the first U.S. Marine was killed trying to secure the Iraqi oil fields. Had you heard those reports, and what did you make of it?
Well, I did hear that, and actually what struck me most was that we were getting a preview, if you will, of how we're going to be informed about the kinds of death and destruction that inevitably occur as a result of this war. And so we're hearing a great deal about a single U.S. Marine who was killed. We're not hearing anything about what the potential Iraqi casualties have been so far, and I expect that we're not going to hear nearly as much about the Iraqi civilians who will inevitably be killed. Any death is tragic, and I wish that the United States would withdraw its troops in order to protect them and keep any more from being killed, but I think that we're going to be hearing an awful lot about U.S. casualties and very little about Iraqi casualties, which in and of itself presents a very grave danger, because at some point, if things go badly for the United States, if the United States suffers a lot of casualties, that's going to be used as an incentive for dramatically escalated levels of force by the U.S., including potentially the use of nuclear weapons.
I want to go back to a point that you made a bit earlier. You said that you believed that the Bush administration was interested in obtaining, securing the oil wells, the Iraqi oil wells, yet the president has said repeatedly that the Iraqi oil belongs to the Iraqi people.
Well, the president has said many things that, in fact, are misstatements with mistruths, misleading, or outright lies. Basically, if we listen to what President Bush and his top advisors and spokespeople say, we are reminded of George Orwell's 1984, where black is white and war is peace, and this is very much a war is peace situation. So I don't think we can accept any statement that is made by members of the Bush administration at their face value, and we have to look at the underlying facts. And the facts are that it is U.S. oil companies who are going to be among the first to benefit from this war should the United States prevail in the way that it hopes to, and that many members of the Bush administration, very high-level people, such as Vice President Cheney, was a CEO of the Halliburton Oil Company before he came back to Washington as part of the Bush administration. So there's no question that there are U.S. oil interests at stake here as part and parcel of this larger drive for, as I said, for global domination.
One of the first things done by the U.S. Marines was to raise the American flag at the port of Qaisar. Why raise the American flag? It's interesting that they were also instructed to take that flag down shortly after it was raised. Did you hear those reports? Does this seem consistent with the stated purpose of this invasion?
Well, I hadn't heard that report, and that's kind of interesting. But what it would suggest to me is that the troops who raised the flag were so full of patriotic zeal based on the rhetoric coming out of the Bush administration that they felt entitled to essentially claim Iraq for the United States. Perhaps some PR people decided that that didn't look so good for the rest of the world. But yes, that's completely consistent with the United States attitude.
Jacqueline Cabasso, Executive Director of the Western States Legal Foundation. As U.S. warplanes continue to bomb Iraq from Kuwait and aircraft carriers remain stationed in the Persian Gulf, the head of the Turkish army gave the final okay for U.S. warplanes to cross his country and initiate northern bombing runs. This on the biggest holiday of the year for Turkey's Kurdish minority population. From Diyarbakir, Aaron Glantz reports.
Tens of thousands of people stand swaying like the wind in a giant parade ground on the outskirts of Diyarbakir, the largest Kurdish-majority city in Turkey. It's Nevroz, the most important day on the Kurdish calendar, commemorating a Kurdish victory centuries ago against the King of Persia. But with the war on Iraq just a few miles away, the celebrations are smaller this year and less festive. Seda is a student.
My emotional state is getting worse. My family is not healthy. Whatever happens at home, they say, forget about that. The war has started. A chemical bomb can fall on us any time. Why should we care? I didn't believe there would be a chemical bomb, and I was trying to change other people's minds about the chemical bomb. But now the possibility is high that a bomb will be dropped on Diyarbakir.
While Kurds prayed for peace celebrating their spring holiday, the Turkish cabinet and army leadership were working behind closed doors, putting the finishing touches on the terms under which U.S. warplanes will be allowed to cross Turkish airspace on their way to bomb Iraq. The Turkish parliament voted yesterday to allow the overflights, but none took place last night because the country's leadership didn't give its final approval. Turkish authorities want to say on what type of airplanes use Turkish airspace, and there are some reports Turkish authorities want to individually approve each bombing run. Turkish authorities are also concerned about the possibility of American military plans to airlift thousands of troops over Turkey directly into Kurdish-controlled northern Iraq. The government in Ankara wants to do everything it can to stop a Kurdish state from being established in the region. At the same time the parliament voted to allow American overflights, it also voted to send the Turkish army into northern Iraq. Sedat is a merchant.
They don't want the Kurds there to exist, either under a federal state or an independent Kurdish state. Turkey doesn't want a Kurdish state, even if it is in America, so it intervenes for that reason. They don't want to give any autonomy to Kurds there. It doesn't have any other aim.
The Turkish army does have two other stated reasons for entering northern Iraq: protecting the small Turkish minority there and preventing any Kurdish refugees from reaching the safety of Turkish soil. During the 1991 Gulf War, more than 500,000 Kurds crossed the mountains into Turkey, and the Turkish army is determined to make sure that doesn't happen again. Sedat thinks there's a 50% chance there will be a Kurdish state when the war is over.
There must be a Kurdish state. There are millions of people without an identity and a state. There is no other place like that in the world. There are states of 5 or 6 people. Kurdish people are 40 million. Is it too much to ask to have a state?
Sedat says Kurdish people don't want their independence through war, though, but through democratic means. Like more than 90% of Turks, Sedat is against the war. But as this story goes to air, the head of the Turkish army, General Hilmi Özkök, gave his approval for U.S. overflights, meaning that tonight U.S. warplanes will be able to bomb Iraq from the north as well as the south. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz with Ezgi Sertas in Diyarbakir, southeastern Turkey.
A quarter of a million U.S. troops are now in the Persian Gulf region. All these men and women were vaccinated against anthrax, willingly or unwillingly. The vaccine has raised concerns among some military and medical personnel. It has dozens of possible serious side effects, including autoimmune disorders and birth defects, and has resulted in the death of at least six people, according to the package insert that comes with the vaccine. On top of that, its effectiveness against anthrax is in question. Melinda Tuhus reports on the efforts of some military and former military personnel to stop the forced vaccination of troops.
Sergeant Brian Fleming planned to make the Marines his life, but after 8 years of active duty, he was retired on full medical disability. That's because a couple of weeks after his fourth anthrax shot in 2000, he suffered from painful acute symptoms that became chronic.
I started having localized joint and muscle pain in my right arm where I received the shot. This pain spread throughout my upper body and then down to my back. My knees, all my extremities were affected. It's arthritis-like pain. At the same time, I started having some serious skin problems, breaking out in hives from head to toes. Extremely uncomfortable, of course. You start developing mental type problems also. It's hard to keep a train of thought, focus on something. Lots of pain behind the eyes, headaches. Just affects your whole body negatively, really.
More than 150,000 service members were vaccinated against anthrax during the first Gulf War. In 1998, the Defense Department began a campaign to vaccinate all 2.5 million members of the military over the next several years. The protocol was a six-shot series followed by annual boosters. That order was not fully carried out because the Food and Drug Administration shut down the manufacturer due to contamination of the product and poor quality control, according to internal documents. The vaccination program started up again last year, focused on those deploying to the new war in the Gulf. Brian Fleming never served in the Gulf, so he was not exposed to the respirable sand, smoke from oil well fires, depleted uranium, or any of the other toxic exposures that some veterans groups believe may cause Gulf War syndrome. He says he spent a year going to medical specialists, but no one was able to diagnose his ailments. However, he's convinced his symptoms stem from the anthrax vaccine.
A lot of people believe that the Gulf War syndrome and what is wrong with us is the exact same thing. It's the exact same symptoms, and if you look at what we have in common with them, it comes back to the anthrax vaccine.
Fleming is one of more than 1,600 service members who filed reports with the Federal Food and Drug Administration about systemic reactions to the vaccine. He and several others have just filed a lawsuit against the maker of the vaccine, BioPort. He says he's seeking damages, not because he's looking for money.
I just want somebody to say, yes, you know, we screwed up. We are guilty of this crime, and we're going to try to make it right. And the best way they can try to make it right is not to do it to anybody else.
Fleming says he doesn't blame the military for what happened and still thinks the Marines are the best outfit in the world. But other military men think the Defense Department shares responsibility for the problem. Redmond Handy was a colonel in the Air Force Reserves who retired in protest over the policy of forced anthrax vaccination. About 700,000 service members have received at least part of the full series of shots. A congressional report in 2000 exposing problems with the vaccine urged that it be made voluntary, but the Pentagon ignored that suggestion. Handy has been researching the issue for 4 years and says that 1,600 reactions is just the tip of the iceberg.
Usually only 1% of the real reaction rate or incidences are filed. That's according to the FDA's own estimate. You could, instead of 1,600, you could be talking, 160,000 reactions in reality. And then the military reports these at a lower rate than the civilian population because it's incredibly important to be in shape, be able to be gung-ho and do your job. And on top of that, you have pressure from commanders and military medical policymakers who so believe in this shot that it becomes a biological loyalty test as opposed to a forced protection measure.
Handy says he knew two of the people who died of complications attributed to the vaccine by the manufacturer.
I've watched two people die a very slow death. Very creeping paralysis over a number of months.
Russ Dingell is a major in the Air Force Reserves who researched the anthrax vaccine on orders from his superior and was shocked at the discrepancies he uncovered.
Well, the military was and is saying it's the safest vaccine that's ever been developed and licensed, and the published literature says that it's one of the most dangerous vaccines that's ever been developed and licensed. the anthrax vaccine is licensed for use in an industrial setting against cutaneous exposure. The military is aware of that. They've been aware of it since at least 1995. They filed an investigational new drug application with the FDA in 1996 in order to get the vaccine licensed for inhalation anthrax.
That application hasn't been acted on yet, but Kimberly Brennan Root, a spokeswoman for the vaccine manufacturer Bioport, says it's not necessary.
The approval of this vaccine was not contingent upon the way that you get the disease or the disease manifestation. The product insert itself and the FDA has also said repeatedly, as well as the Institute of Medicine, has said that this vaccine protects against all forms of anthrax as well as all strains of anthrax.
She declined comment on any of the anthrax-related lawsuits filed against the company. A class action lawsuit was filed on March 19th by several active duty members of the military, reservists, and civilian Pentagon employees who are also forced to get the anthrax vaccine. It seeks to require the Pentagon to end the forced vaccination program. It further seeks to have the FDA declare the vaccine an investigational new drug that has not been approved for its intended use, and that therefore requires informed consent or a presidential waiver of such consent to be administered. Since 1998, almost 500 active-duty service members have refused the vaccine, and more than 100 have been court-martialed, according to data released in connection with the lawsuit. A Pentagon spokesman released a written statement saying that the Department of Defense obtained confirmation from the FDA that the anthrax vaccine is licensed for protection against inhalation anthrax. He said the immunization program provides essential protection for U.S. military forces deployed to the Persian Gulf area, who may confront an anthrax attack by Saddam Hussein. Dr. Merle Nass is a civilian internist specializing in Gulf War illness and reactions to the anthrax vaccine. She says the vaccine is an experimental drug when given to prevent inhalation anthrax, such as might be encountered in biological weapons in the Gulf War. She says the vaccine should not be mandatory, and she points out a precedent.
In the United Kingdom, soldiers get to choose whether to take the anthrax vaccine, and more than half of them who are being deployed to the Persian Gulf are refusing it.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven, Connecticut.
The FDA did not return phone calls seeking comments for that piece. Hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops, heavy fighting artillery, including new and improved Patriot anti-missile systems, or the PAC-3, some 290 modern Abram tanks, 270 Bradley fighting vehicles, and much, much more. So what's the sticker price of this war? Joining us in the studio is Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Binsky, who has been in Washington this week for our special coverage. Larry, you've been monitoring Capitol Hill. Are American taxpayers any closer to knowing what the economic cost of this war will be?
The short answer is no, but we do know some sticker prices, Verna. For example, the ferocious Tomahawk cruise missiles, which are probably causing a great loss of life today in Baghdad, cost $1 million apiece. The cost of what the United States is now doing is estimated at somewhere around $75 to $100 billion, and none of this has come up for congressional approval yet. There will be a supplemental request next week. Rumors are that it's going to be somewhere in the $75 billion range, but from the nature of the debate so far in Congress, it doesn't seem like very few people indeed, will be willing to give close examination to what the military is asking for, which what in effect will be a blank check.
And so is there any kind of timetable for this, Larry?
The timetable right now is they're considering a budget resolution. The House last night passed it by 3 votes, even though the Republicans have a 24-vote to majority in the House of Representatives. And the Senate, as we speak, is considering about the 10th of 100 different amendments. So the timetable is it's all tied up in knots right now.
Okay. Larry Binsky, National Affairs Correspondent. Verna Avery Brown, this is a special edition of Peace Watch. We'll be back with Larry in a moment.